So people pay you
to even just look and find?
They don't pay me to look. So,
well, I was about to say, I'm about to start looking for some properties.
They kind of do, but I don't like taking money up front. Okay. So I get paid essentially once I find the property and negotiate the deal for you, okay. Right? So I actually have to do my job before I get paid.
Hi guys, welcome to another episode of What My Best Friend Does with me, your host Bio, where we talk about what your best friends do so you don't have to. Today, I'm joined by my best friend, the Chartered Surveyor. James, how you doing, bro?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Good, thanks
for having me. All things considered.
thank you so much for coming on the show. We like to start with a little icebreaker.
Yep.
What did you want to be growing up?
Initially wanted to be a lawyer. Purely from TV, just watching too much TV growing up.
What, Suits?
Suits, I don't know what else, but yeah, I think that was the main one.
The Black Harvey Specter.
yeah, wanted to be a solicitor.
Yeah.
Just thought it would be sexy. And yeah, grew out of that quite quickly.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, you wanted to be a lawyer. You've ended up as a chartered surveyor. Talk us through your journey to this point.
So I actually did go down the law route. So studied law at uni, did my professional law exams, my LPC as well.
Wow.
Yeah, so committed quite far down the line. And then, yeah, just decided I didn't want to do that anymore.
Sorry to jump in there. What was the turning point? Why didn't you want to do it anymore?
I think there were a couple of turning points. I think it was as I had more understanding of what the role actually entailed and what the day-to-day life would be like, it started becoming more unattractive, essentially. Just long hours, stuck in the office, boring cases. Just didn't sound great to me. And so I just thought, you know what, no point wasting my time doing this. But yeah, here I am.
After you decide to scrap law, what's the kind of next step in your journey?
So I was working a sales job, literally just selling data intelligence to pharmaceutical companies, biotechs. Again, it's a sales role. I was okay, not fantastic, but making enough money. And I just thought, you know what? I don't want to do this either. So I quit that job and literally just set up the company and just started running with it.
So you set up the company. When you set up the company, did you know what it was you wanted to do at the time?
I knew there was a niche within the property sector that I had some sort of experience with, and that I understood. So my initial thoughts were to target that niche and then see how it goes from there. I think I was 23, 24. So I was young and brave. I'd probably do it differently if I had my time again. I'd probably wait till I was a little bit older. But yeah, at the time, had a sort of safety net. I was living at home, so expenses were kind of low. But yeah, it made sense at the time for me and it worked out okay.
You mentioned that you had a niche. Mm-hmm. What was that niche?
The niche was working with churches, which is extremely niche. The way property works in the UK, everything has a designated use class. Mm-hmm. So for example, an office is E-class, retail is E-class, meaning that those properties can only be used for certain things which come under that category.
Mm-hmm.
So churches fell under D1 at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was a case of churches can only operate from D1 properties, and it's very, very difficult to find those properties. There's not enough of them. So my job was essentially going around locating these properties and, again, finding people that were looking for the property. So a matchmaking service, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Obviously, yeah, like you said, now you're a chartered surveyor. I'm assuming that also takes some kind of qualification.
Anyone can be a surveyor. So as in you can do the actual work without being chartered. So the chartered status comes from the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors. And for that, yes, you have to go through a whole process, sit some exams, have an assessment to make sure that you're adequate to come underneath the body. You need insurance and all sorts of things like that as well.
How long does the process take?
It depends. there's quite a few routes. So
for the route you took?
The route I took was preliminary something. Anyway, okay. It's because I had previous experience. So mm-hmm. because I had 5 years experience, mm-hmm. I could skip the actual university degree part mm-hmm. that I would have had to do and go straight to the assessment.
Oh, wow.
So technically it took me 5 years plus the year and a half that I needed to get my case study ready mm-hmm. and actually sit the assessment. So mm-hmm. 6.5 years. But if you were to do the degree, it would be 3 years for a uni degree or 2 years for a master's and then your APC, which is your assessment of professional competence, which is the case study and the assessment.
And then I know, speaking to you, there's like many different forms of surveyor you can become, right?
Yes.
And is it like, you know, you've mentioned the fact that you specialize in D1. Is it like for every class, or for E, there's a chartered surveyor qualification, for F?
No. So it's split into disciplines.
Okay.
So I'm a commercial surveyor, which means...
Oh, and there's quantity, isn't there? Yeah, quantity surveyor is the one that everybody knows.
That's the one everyone knows.
Yeah.
A commercial surveyor deals with commercial aspects of leases, sales, landlords and tenant issues. Mm-hmm. So it's the majority of it is, if you think of it as like a residential estate agent, mm-hmm. but with businesses. And when you're going to move into a new house, whether you're buying or let's say you're leasing a house, the leases I deal with are 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. As opposed to you go into a house, or most people go into a house for 1 or 2 years. So there's a lot more things.
Most people go into a house for 1 or 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, if you're just renting, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Again, most people are renting, which is the same in commercial property, right?
Okay.
Most businesses don't own the building that they operate from. So they're there on a lease. The same as most people don't actually own their home. They rent, they're there on a lease. Okay. So businesses need stability, right? So they're looking at long-term leases because they don't want to have to move their business every year. Whereas an individual in a home, okay, if they've got a family, it's more difficult, but most people can move every 1 or 2 years. It doesn't really matter. But for a business, your location is quite important. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more things that need to be negotiated just because the lease is long-term. And again, same with the purchase. There's just way more things that come into it rather than an individual just purchasing for themselves.
You had the 5 years experience. Mm-hmm. You've done the 1.5 years with the examination and case study. That kind of brings us, not to date, but like you've been doing it obviously for some time. Talk me through like a typical day or week now for you, now that you are this chartered surveyor.
I would say I'm 60% in the office, 40% out of the office. So 60% I'm in the office, just at my desk, sort of either on the phone or just looking for sites online. Talking to agents, talking to landlords, talking to investors, talking to potential tenants, just trying to see what people are looking for, what I've got available, what I know is available, and just trying to piece things together. The other 40%, I'm out actually looking at sites, either with clients or just driving around.
Do you wear a high-vis jacket when you go on site?
Only if it's a building site.
What about helmet?
If it's a building site.
Okay.
So again, like, if you're on a building site, then you've got to adhere to all the sort of health and safety stuff.
Even if it's like a brand new building, you've got to wear all these things.
If it's still under construction, yes. Okay. It's super annoying as well. Because you've got to wear someone else's boots. And
else's boots?
It's actually a nightmare. it's grim. But yeah, you've got to be safe, right? You don't want to step on a nail or something like that if you've got your loafers on.
So
to be fair, last week, I think I had 2 viewings a day. So I was out of the office quite a lot. So that skewed probably the other way around. And again, I don't have a geographical patch that I work in. So I can be in Hertfordshire, I can be in Surrey. I'll go as far as sort of Liverpool, Manchester. I've got clients up there as well. But I don't want to go there too often, ideally. Cool. But yeah, because we're working within a niche sort of sector, we go where our clients are essentially. So,
and obviously you mentioned the fact that you started your company quite young. Mm-hmm. Like, for somebody who's started the company quite young, like, where do you source those clients? You know, you mentioned you had your niche, mm-hmm. but for somebody who's potentially looking to set up their own thing, win those initial clients, even win clients, you know, at this point today, what's the typical process you take?
There's a couple of things you can do. The first thing I would say is that I deal with businesses. So being that you deal with businesses, they need things, right? So businesses have needs. A lot of my clients, so one of my key clients at the moment are nurseries, children's nurseries. Now, there's obviously a massive need for children's nurseries in the UK, that there just aren't enough childcare places. So a lot of my clients are looking to grow quite aggressively. Mm-hmm. So it's a case of, I literally get on the phone. I might have a day where, okay, I've got no viewings or anything. I'm just in the office. I'll just get on the phone. Or, well, I'll go on LinkedIn or whatever, look up top 20 nursery chains in the UK, find out who's in specific property related positions at those companies, and just try and make contact. So it may be emails, it may be phone calls, bit of cold calling involved. But once I get them on the phone, typically because they want to grow, they are looking for people like me that have the contacts or the sites that they need to be able to expand. Mm-hmm. So I think it depends on what sort of offering you're giving. But what I would say is, in terms of property, people need properties. Mm-hmm. So networking is massive, but also you're networking with people that are always looking for deals. They're always looking for opportunities. Mm-hmm. So it's actually not too difficult within the property sector to sort of get clients. Again, I'll say networking events. And I think I've chosen to target sort of industry specific events rather than broader property events, because my sectors are quite niche. So I might go to a childcare expo where all the nurseries are there. So it's education focused.
Yeah.
You've got colleges, you've got schools, you've got children's nurseries there. Mm-hmm. And they're all there to learn about the education space. But everyone I need to know will be at that event.
Or they can at least plug you with somebody.
Exactly. It's just a networking thing. I'll just go, I'll talk to people, see what they're looking to do, mm-hmm. see what they're looking to build, mm-hmm. And then go from there.
Okay, so that's the client side. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming from the way you've kind of spoken about your job, you're like the middleman between the client and then the property itself.
Yeah.
How is it that you're sourcing the actual properties, and how are you making sure you're not getting cut out of the deals as well?
Yeah. So it's a mixture of things. The industry, again, is small, and property is one of those things where you don't want to make mistakes, and you don't want to get a bad reputation. Mm-hmm. So initially I'll sign an agreement with my clients to say, okay, I'm going to be looking on your behalf, I'm going to charge you X amount, and this is, you'll give me the parameters that I'm looking for. I will then go out and search for those sites.
So people pay you to even just look and find?
They don't pay me to look. So, okay.
Well, I was about to say, I'm about to start looking for some properties.
They kind of do, but I don't like taking money up front. Okay. So I get paid essentially once I find the property and negotiate the deal for you, okay. Right? So I actually have to do my job before I get paid. Mm-hmm. There are people that have offered to say, okay, we want you to be really active for us, so take some money up front. But that comes with expectations, mm-hmm. right? So, and I'd rather not get into that situation. So
you're a bit like no win, no fee.
Literally no win, no fee.
The best
it's,
way to
it, yeah, exactly. It's a free service. If I don't perform, if I do perform, I get paid. Perfect, mm-hmm. right?
Do you drink from both sides?
Well, no.
You drink from the client side? Like you find yes. the property?
So I will either act for a landlord or a tenant.
Okay.
So again, being chartered, there's rules around having conflicts of interest. How can you negotiate for two opposing sides fairly, right?
Like, there's the entrepreneur in me, I guess.
Yeah, it probably can be done.
Okay,
but not by chartered,
because it's like monopolizing, right? Because you can just make the price.
It's just not fair. You need to be impartial, right? So you act either landlord side or tenant side, or buyer or seller side, depending on what the deal is.
Mm-hmm. What's better?
I would say landlord side is probably better, just because you're going to get paid regardless whoever takes the property. So if you've got a property that you want to rent out or you want to sell, mm-hmm. and I'm doing that on your behalf, I don't care who buys it, I don't care who rents it, because I'm going to get paid.
Yeah.
On the flip side, so I work acquisition side. So most of my clients are looking to buy properties or looking to rent properties. So I only get paid if I do the deal for them, mm-hmm. right? So if I introduce a property, we negotiate for it, and then the landlord or seller chooses someone else, I don't get paid. Even though I've spent time, I've spent effort, but I didn't perform, right? So I don't get paid. So I'd say it's probably better to be on the disposal side, which is selling and renting.
What are the key factors that determine the value and marketability of commercial properties, and how do you assess them as a surveyor?
I'll use nurseries because that's probably my main client at the moment. So in terms of nurseries, we are looking for sites that help their businesses, and every business will be different. So if you're looking at an office or you're looking at McDonald's or Burger King, whatever it is, they will have different things that they're looking at. But in terms of nurseries, ideally you want to be close to good transport links. You want to be close to lots of housing. Mm-hmm. You want to be in areas where there's lots of families, high income households, good house prices, just because those people tend to have disposable income, which is what you use to pay for nursery fees, right? So for me, those are the key things that I'm looking at when I'm sort of making my assessments. Then I'm looking at the size of the building, whether it has car parking space, whether it has a garden because the children need to go outdoors, for instance. All of that is what I'm looking at, how easy it is for that building to be used for my client's purposes, right? So technically any building could be used if you change the use, but changing the use takes time, and the amount of refurb that might be needed to turn, let's say, a car garage into a children's nursery, it's just going to be massive amounts of money that you need to refurb that. So
I was going to ask about that changing of use.
Yeah.
You mentioned there that it's going to take a bit of time. Mm-hmm. Like, on average, how long would that typically take?
Councils are having a really tough time at the moment. Yeah. I think they're probably quite, well, they're understaffed and there's a lot of applications. So it's supposed to be 8 weeks from when you submit, you're supposed to get an answer within 8 weeks, but that never happens.
Okay.
So, I mean, really, you're looking at 3.5-4 months.
And does it cost money to change?
Yes. So
I'm not surprised.
Well, you need a professional. You can do it yourself, but there's a lot that might go into it. So for a change of use application, depending on what it is, you might need a transport survey. So for a nursery, for instance, you're going to need to show that, okay, because now you're going to have loads of parents coming to drop kids off here, how many of them are going to be driving? Are you going to be causing chaos on the roads?
Mad.
Right, like, so you need a transport survey.
Yeah.
Noise surveys, okay. Children are really noisy.
Yeah.
So, okay, how far is this noise going to travel? Is it going to disturb neighbours? Are you going to get complaints? You'll do a like a public review. You put some questionnaires out to neighbours and they basically talk to all the neighbours to make sure that they're not going to be affected too detrimentally.
Pissed off.
Yeah. By the fact that this new use is coming in here, right? The councils, there's just a lot that goes into it. So yes, you can do it yourselves, but at times you're going to need professionals to actually do those surveys for you. You can't do them.
Yeah. That's mad.
Yeah.
I thought like the setup of a nursery, it'd just be like, buy a house, buy two houses, knock the wall down in the middle, and just welcome all the kids. Do some, what is it, DBS check or CRB check. Yeah. And then that's it. But no, it's not that simple.
Nothing is as simple as it looks. And I think people have this idea that property is really, really simple.
Mm.
And it's just not. Everything is difficult. Everything costs money. Everything takes time. I mean, if you're dealing with residential, then maybe it's slightly more straightforward. Residential, maybe smaller scale developments. Yes, yeah, so slightly more straightforward. But the vast majority of it is super complex.
That takes me back to what you were saying at the start. You studied law at university. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like your degree has helped you in these complex situations, and are the skills transferable?
Yeah, no, definitely. So one of my core modules in my LPC was commercial property.
Okay.
So that was probably going to be the route that I went down if I decided to be a solicitor anyway. So yeah, I understand contracts. I understand, I get how it all works, which I think works in my benefit, because then I can propose maybe different solutions that other people might not think of or might not be able to see. And just in terms of structuring deals, I think it gives me a definite advantage.
And like, do you feel like because of that as well, you can like call bullshit? Like, have people ever tried to like do fugazi on you and hit you with some terms? And you're like, nah, this ain't it, bruh.
The good thing about property is that everything can be checked, mm-hmm. right? Everything's at land registry. There's a lot of property data that we as surveyors have access to that we can just check, look at prices. We can see how much you paid for the property. So it's the lies tend to be around how much profit they're going to make and all those sorts of things where we can just check. But yeah, it's not necessarily terms that people are trying to lie about.
I hear you. And following on from that, in your experience, what are the common mistakes or oversights that property owners make when it comes to surveying their commercial properties?
I would say it's thinking you can, to my earlier point, I think it's thinking it's simple and therefore thinking that you don't need agents, you don't need qualified professionals, and you can just do it yourself. Mm. Some people will get away with it, but in my opinion, it's just not worth it. It's anything that goes wrong with a property will be extremely expensive. So you're trying to save a couple of grand on fees by doing something yourself, whereas on the back end, you might lose tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, depending on what goes wrong, right? So that's probably one of the biggest things that I see people sort of get wrong. And it's a oversimplification of what the processes involved are. And I've got it at the moment, actually, with one client. They're selling a property to buy another one. And they seem to think that they're just going to sell this property within sort of 2-3 months and it's all going to be done fine and dandy. And then they're going to put that cash into this new purchase. Mm-hmm. And that's just never going to happen. Not in this, especially not in this market. And you need to make sure that you time everything well with the seller of the new property, because he needs to be able to wait for you to sell that. And that sale, I think, will take several months. Mm-hmm. So it's just things like that, just overestimating the sort of timescales involved and all that sort of thing can be problematic. And when you don't have advice, your deal starts to crumble. That's the problem.
And when you see this happening, right, so you're advising your client and they're kind of, because, you know, rich people think they know everything. Mm-hmm. Let's be real.
They know a lot.
they do know a lot. Obviously, that's why they got the bread. But like when you see this happening, right, so you're advising them this ain't going to be as quick. Mm-hmm. But they're like, no, let's just like push forward, do whatever. How do you navigate those conversations to maintain like a positive relationship?
There needs to be a realization from agents that it's not my money, right? Mm-hmm. It's not my, yes, I'm trying to complete this deal so that I can get paid, etc. So I'm heavily invested in it. But ultimately, it's the client's decision what they want to do. I can't force a client to do anything. Mm-hmm. If they don't want to do it, they don't want to do it. So all I can do is talk. All I can do is put it in writing. I don't think this is a great idea. I think we should do X, Y, Z. If you choose to go against that's not a problem. It's fine. Obviously, you could do what you like. But you won't be able to come back and say, it's your fault, you should have, because I will have it in writing that I advised you this, you did something else, simple. So, and that I think stops a lot of conflicts, and it stops he said, she said. And if anything, later on in later dealings, that client might listen to you next time because of how that first transaction went. So it can work in your favor.
So what I'm hearing there is to avoid conflict, make sure you have the receipts.
Always got receipts.
Yeah, always keep receipts. Document transactions. Mm-hmm. And it's not I told you so. It's just a presentation of the facts.
Yeah. It's, I think you should do this because X, Y, Z. But obviously, it's your choice. But this would be my advice. Done.
So because of like that kind of outlook that you have when dealing with your clients, I suppose in my mind I'm thinking, has there ever been a situation where as an agent you've just gone, nah, these clients are long, like this ain't for me? Like what would take you to the end of your tether?
Probably fees. I think the only times that I've had really big issues with client, well, not even big issues, it's just we don't agree. So it's, you're trying to negotiate my fee down and I'm saying this is a lot of work, the fee needs to be X. And they're saying, no, we're only going to pay Y. Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't have to do the work. You can find someone that will do it for that price, fine, but it's not going to be me.
And the quality of work will be representative of the fee they're trying to command.
Maybe not. They might do the job well, right?
So I think that comes from understanding your worth, right? So you know your worth and you're not willing to be or feel undervalued.
You only have a certain amount of time, mm-hmm. right? So I can only work on so many transactions at a time. And if I know something is going to cause me a lot of headache, and this is the thing, some deals are way easier than others. So if I compare some of the church clients or charity clients, there's a lot of regulation around how charities operate. And it's just, you need to do a lot of background reading, make sure and double check and make sure the trustees are advised properly. There's way more risk and it's way more time consuming versus a company, so a nursery, which is essentially a corporate entity, the amounts of time I need to spend, because the nursery, especially if it's a chain, they know what they're doing. They've done this hundreds of times or tens of times, whatever it is, and they just know how the process goes. I know that they're all professionals within that organization and they've got their checks and balances is right. And that's a way easier transaction for me to do than this one. So it's a case of, if I'm looking at this one, okay, it takes twice as much time and effort, might need to be a slightly larger fee.
For the listener,
yeah,
are you a religious man?
I am.
So do you feel compelled to help churches when they come to you?
That has to be balanced. Mm-hmm. I do feel compelled. And actually, it's not just churches. I feel compelled to help charities. Mm-hmm. These are people that are trying to do good stuff in society, providing an essential service to society. And most agents, most people ignore them, because the fees aren't great and they're quite
demanding.
They're demanding. They're time consuming to deal with, as I sort of just said.
Because they want to get the bang for their buck, right? Because
they don't have it. But ultimately, they're a charity, so they can't necessarily compete with some of the people they will be competing with, right? So it means they're going to bid less on properties, but you still have to go through the whole process. They're going to bid less and they're probably not going to get it, but you're still going to spend your time. So a lot of agents just ignore them for those sorts of reasons. Now, I feel compelled to help them, one, because I'm religious, but two, because they do good for society. But that has to be balanced, because you can spend an awful lot of time for no reason.
Yeah.
And because I only collect fees on the back end, like, I need to be very, very careful with that sort of thing, mm-hmm. And just make sure I'm not wasting time.
So on the topic of fees, mm-hmm. we don't need to talk specifics, mm-hmm. but how would you say, like, the fee for a charity or church compares to the typical fee for, like, a nursery?
So it's the same.
Or like a range. Oh, okay.
So it's the same. So our fees are set and they're pretty...
Because I thought you were saying you were charging higher fees because they demand more of your time.
So the bulk of my work, which is the agency work in terms of finding the properties, negotiating the deals, that side of things, the fees are set. So it's 2% for a purchase and it's 10% of the annual rent if it's a leasehold property, right? So if you're saying the property costs £1 million, 2% is 20 grand. If the rent's £100,000 a year, 10% is 100 grand, right? So that's roughly what you're paying with. And obviously the price of the property will change. So everybody knows where they stand, right? The figures, the percentages don't change. All that changes is the price of the property.
Okay.
And then there's a sliding scale, obviously. If you're talking about stuff over sort of 5 million, you drop the percentage, right? Because then that becomes a very, very large fee. And obviously as you go up, percentage drops and drops and drops. But for work like, if it's a rent review, for example, or it's a... So charities, for example, have to... if they want to rent a property to somebody or sell a property to somebody that is connected to the charity, they need to get a report from a surveyor, mm-hmm. right? So for a report like that, I would charge a fee based on how long I think it's going to take me and how complex it is. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was saying, that I might need to charge something that makes sense with the amount of time that I'm going to spend on it. But if we're fighting over that, it's just not worth it.
How many projects will you work at any one time?
Between 5 to 10 on the go.
Wow.
Again, not all of those will come off, mm-hmm. right? So some of those I'm going to lose, some of them I'm going to win. So I think on average, I'll probably do 8 to 12 deals a year. Mm-hmm. So
I'll
average one a month.
So the cycles are quite long.
Yes. So I've got stuff that I've been working on for a year that is just closed, sort of thing. So it's
by it closed, amen.
By it closed, amen. Glory be to God. But again, it's dependent, right? So if you need planning, for example, so when we're talking about the changes of use, if you need a change of use, that automatically is going to add 4+ months onto your deal time, right? Mm-hmm. The legal work is not going to take less than 3 months. So it's just sometimes these deals, again, if you're talking about purchasing, can just take months and months and months. So it's about building up a pipeline, and you're not necessarily going to have immediate, well, you can do sort of quick deals and have some immediate success, but most of them are going to take time. And so your pipeline has to be strong so that it's built out over a long period of time.
Is this one of the things that you wish you knew a little bit more about when you first got into it?
I think understanding how the amount of calls you make, the amount of viewings you go on, feed into how many deals you actually close. So just understanding your KPIs and then how that translates into actual closed deals and therefore funds. I think I could have understood that a little bit earlier and just made sure I was doing a bit more and not sort of resting on my laurels.
This is great. I think one thing I want to ask, I've got so many questions, like my head is going all over the place. Like, obviously you own your own business, mm-hmm. but you've previously, you know, worked in sales. Mm-hmm. What's the difference when you're kind of, it's eat what you kill, isn't it? How does it differ from working for like a corporate where you know you've got a steady income?
The main difference is security. So I think if you're working for somebody, you just have that security, right? You know that either way, you're going to get paid at the end of the month. The difference when you have your own business is that's not the case, right? If you don't do any business, you don't get paid. Mm. And you will most of the time owe money. You might have an office, you might have people working for you, you might have all sorts of stuff going on, business rates, all sorts of things. So I think that's the key difference, is just the security isn't there. And
do you think that security drives you to work harder than you would if you worked for a company?
Oh, 100%. 100%. Because it's just you, yeah. Right? So there's no one's going to save you. No one's going to save you. You have to save yourself. So yeah, I mean, there's been times, again, thank God I'm in a much better place now. But when I started out, it was very, very tough. Like I wasn't doing that many deals, and you're working and you're seeing your friends doing great things and they're at XYZ Bank and everyone's flying, right? And you're just a bit like, oh, what am I doing here? Have I made the right decision? But over time, once you become more established, I mean, I've been doing this for 8 years now. So now I'm in a more comfortable place, settled. My pipeline's good. I understand what I need to do to get certain outputs. Again, the more time you spend in an industry, as I'm sure everyone finds in their own industries, more senior you become, the bigger deals you start to work on, you just get slightly more exposure.
Mate, I 100% agree. And it brings me back to something that I've like been told before, and I think it's so true. Sometimes people work the same job at a company, mm-hmm. but a more senior person or somebody who's more tenured will get paid more. Mm-hmm. And people can't for the life of them think, we do the same job. Why does that person get paid more than me? Mm. And the reason I've been told is because with that experience comes experience during tested times. And the difference in salary is because they have experience in working through rocky times.
Yep.
And I think people don't understand that. People just look at what they're doing in that moment. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, wow, it's so true. I'd never thought about it like that.
Yeah, I think there's a big misunderstanding in terms of like how hard someone's working and the outputs that they get. There's not necessarily a correlation. Yeah, to some extent it helps.
Mm.
But I know people that make fortunes and
they don't work that hard.
They don't work that hard.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's...
And on the reverse, I know people who work damn hard and they don't earn any fortune. Right.
And I think understanding that is very, very helpful.
Yeah.
It just puts you in a better space to just say, okay, look, I'm focused on me. It's not unfair. it's not, it just is what it is. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do the best I can. For me, I'm going to work hard, yes, but I'm going to try and work smart as well, right? Yeah, and just, yeah, understanding that balance is, yeah, it's important. Yeah, it is important.
And like, you spoke about how it was really difficult mm-hmm. at the beginning, right? Like, how do you maintain your resilience? Like, what is it that gave you the belief that you knew that things were going to turn around?
I need to trust the process. Mm-hmm. Like, it takes time. Nothing good happens overnight. Like, it's really only now that I'm benefiting from the sort of 8 years. Now, I work with a lot of big clients. So again, they want better properties, bigger properties. They want more properties. Mm-hmm. So all of that means more fees. Mm-hmm. But if I didn't have the previous 8 years mm-hmm. struggling, figuring it out, I couldn't get to this space. And I think trusting that I would get here, mm-hmm. rightly or wrongly, mm-hmm. is what allows you to sort of stay mm-hmm. and just trust yourself, yeah, basically. All you can do in that situation is trust yourself.
So I listen a lot to Alex Hormozy, as you know, and I think one of the things that he says a lot that resonates with me is just think of everything like big picture. So if you're starting in a new career or you're starting like a new venture, don't think about what it's going to be in 1 year, 2 years. Think about what it's going to be in 10 years, in 20 years, in 30 years. And when you start to expand your time horizons and like you dedicate yourself over, you know, the weeks, the months, the years, that's when you'll really see significant change or significant success. I mean, you know, he's also mentioned like Warren Buffett, right? Like Warren Buffett, it's just slow and steady and boring. Like he's made the majority of his wealth mm-hmm. from like 70 to 90 or in the last few years. Yep. But he says that nobody wants to get rich slow.
And I think that is the thing. Everybody wants to blow up quickly. Mm. And I guess the more difficult thing for those coming up now or starting their careers now is that that can happen now because of YouTube, because of TikTok. There are a lot of ways that you can explode overnight, whereas that wasn't necessarily the case before. You needed track record. You need to prove yourself. And I think that's the route that I've chosen to go down. Take time, slowly grow.
The
traditional route. Yeah. But also like, property is property for a reason. It's stable. Over a long time period, you will make money. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point that people invest in property. It's for their futures. And so I have to look at my business the same way because it's a property service business, right? So it's a case of I need to take that sort of long-term view as well and just not expect it to happen overnight. And actually, the other thing that I would add just on that is that when you're young, very few people are in positions of power in terms of your network, right? So it's only really now that I'm able to sort of start doing business with peers mm-hmm. because now everybody's more senior in their respective jobs and whatever. Yeah. Whereas before, everyone's green, everyone's just started in the office.
So true.
They don't have any decision-making power, right? But as you grow up and you spend time in an industry, you become more senior, people trust you more, you have better contacts, and that allows you to do more business and in turn make more money.
Yeah.
So that time in the industry is so important. There isn't a shortcut to that.
Yeah, like the bring-ins. Like now you're in a position where you can like recommend people for jobs and it carries weight.
100%.
Now you're in a position where, you know, maybe you can even employ people, give people work experience.
Literally.
And these are things that they don't tell you, right? You don't just get all of these advantages off the bat. You've got to earn them.
I think that's a lot of what business is. Rightly or wrongly, people do business with people they like and that they trust. And I can like and trust my friends, but if they're so junior that they can't do anything, that's not necessarily a good business contact. It doesn't mean they're not a good friend, mm-hmm. but as in terms of business, that's not particularly useful. Yeah. And so getting to a stage where you can make things happen and now we're in a position is extremely helpful. Like, I recommend my friends that are lawyers to clients all the time. If I have a client that needs something, most of the times I'm going to recommend someone that I know, that I trust, that I like.
And because they've also got the years in the field now.
Exactly. They know what they're doing. They're good at their job. So why not recommend them? What, yeah. I could just go on Google and pick anyone and give some random person business, but why would I do that?
Like, yeah,
if I know you're good at your job.
Talking around, like, you know, the longevity of the property profession, just in terms of staying on top of things, how do you stay updated with the latest regulations and guidelines that impact commercial surveying, and how do you ensure compliance with them in your assessments?
RICS has a lot of guidance in terms of what to do, what not to do. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of, well, we get almost weekly or bi-weekly emails in terms of new regulation updates, all that sort of stuff. So RICS will keep you up to date with that. And the second bit of that was just in terms of how I make sure my assessments are in line. So again, there is guidance on everything. So no matter what, whether it's evaluation, whether it's a rent review, lease, whatever it is, there is literally a checklist that you go through to do that work. So
in terms of like emerging trends, is there anything that's happening at the moment? I mean, I know that property is kind of set in its ways, but you know, with AI and technology, have you noticed anything at the moment?
Actually, one thing I did see the other day, I think it's CBRE, they've set up like a ChatGPT thing for property management. So they're trying to use AI to manage client sites and stuff like that. So I think there's going to be a little bit more of the automation side. And so putting in certain factors into a computer and it's spitting out answers. I don't think we necessarily have too much of that in property at the moment, but I think that's going to be where things sort of go. So automating processes that people would usually be doing.
And is that going to make your job easier, or does that threaten potentially some of the work that you do and things that you can charge for, or both? Well,
yeah, probably both. Look, it probably is a threat, but I think one of the things I've benefited from is that my sector is quite small. I keep saying, it's niche. There isn't a lot of data on our sector. So because it is so niche, it's not something that people are focused on necessarily. And so the reason I can say that is there's probably three companies that focus on the area that I focus on. And we get calls, I know all of them well, and we all get calls all the time from your bigger agents trying to get comparable data. So trying to find out, okay, what this site would sell for, what do you think that's worth, blah, blah, blah. Because it is so niche, we have all the expertise is between three companies, essentially. So
when there's interest in a site and all three companies start calling, does that inherently drive the value of a property up in that moment?
Yes, it does. So and that's the nature of our sector, right? So too few properties and too many people that want them. Right, which is
a lovely position to be in. It's
a great position to be in, right? Supply and demand issues. But what it does
every time I'm on this podcast, I'm like, damn, I need to change what I'm doing. No, I'm joking. I'm joking. I love customer success. In case anyone from work is watching this, I love what I do.
I think supply and demand issues put people in a difficult situation. If you really want the property, you have to pay for it. And for us three companies that are very often competing for the same sites, it's a case of, so if a client, and again, we've got clients that are sort of signed up with all of us, right? So it's whoever sends you the property first, that's who you go with.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if I send you the property first and a day later he sends it to you, you pursue it with me, right? And so
does that always happen though?
I have no idea. I wouldn't know, right? So, I mean, I'll send out sites. Sometimes I get nothing back. Sometimes I get no, wrong area, too small, too big, whatever it may be.
Because there could be like a little backhander. Oh, if you go with us, hey, but you just don't know what you don't know.
It comes around though. This is the thing. And
what, you give up backhander? No, I'm joking. Let me not put you on the spot. No, I'm joking.
As in like, what goes around comes around. Niche industry. So if you start screwing people over, likely
you'll get screwed
over. That's going to get out. Reputational damage, and people will start to do that to you.
So that was going to be one of my questions. if you're all working the same thing, it's whoever sources the opportunity first.
Yes.
So you're on like right move or whatever, like refresh it.
To be honest, it's actually, I do spend time on Rightmove, but not massive.
But like whatever site it is that you use for your, or is it not a website?
It's a mixture of sites. So I've got a list of probably 300-400 like property websites that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot. So yes, Rightmove aggregates some of that, but it's so far behind. The data's so old. So I'm sure everyone that's tried to get a residential property knows, you go on Rightmove, oh, you call up about a property, it's already gone. Like, because they don't update the data regularly. They can't. It's too much data. And property moves in this sense. It can move quite quickly in terms of it's available. We agree a deal now. Then it's no longer available.
Yeah,
but that might take a week or 2 weeks to filter down to Rightmove before they take it off their platform. Sort mm-hmm. So it's more conversations. So speaking to agents, trying to get the early on stuff, speaking to landlords, all of that stuff is way more important. And that's the relationship side of things, right? So maintaining those relationships so that when they get a property and they think, oh, this could work for a nursery or a church or a gym or whatever it may be, who do I want to call? I know he works with a lot of those guys, so give him a call, sort of thing.
And
so
how do you nurture those relationships to make sure that you are top of mind when those opportunities do arise?
There are a lot of time wasters in property, and try not to waste people's time. If you send me something, I'll have a look at it. We can have a chat about it. I can put it out to my clients. If I'm not getting any feedback, I'll let you know, I don't think this one's going to work. Mm-hmm. Or so-and-so said this, or they said that. Not really one for us. So fine. So you can move on. I don't want to keep you there waiting to hear from me and you're not hearing anything, thinking that I'm going to do something with it and you're not speaking to other people, because it's a waste of time for you, right? I'm delaying your transaction by keeping quiet. So I think managing that, just being straightforward as well. Just, I'm very open. So, and that's with clients and that's with other agents. Just very open. I say what it is. This is what we can do. We can't do that. This is where our line is. And that tends to have worked for me so far. So I think people appreciate that rather than them trying to figure out, oh, is he lying? Is there a bit more? Is he holding something back? If I've been told this is the bottom line, this is the bottom, we can't pay up anymore. Mm. It's simple. If you guys want to do a deal, we'll do a deal quickly, but it needs to be this.
So you've mentioned communication and transparency there. Mm-hmm. What are some other skills that you see amongst the best kind of chartered surveyors, and what are the skills that help you to be successful, you think people need to consider before getting into the industry?
Patience. So I think
have a little patience. Sorry.
I think the how did you just word it? The transparency and
communication.
I think that's probably the key one, because it's a relationship business. Mm-hmm. And you're negotiating with a person. If someone doesn't like you, that negotiation is going to be 10 times harder because they don't like you. Mm-hmm. So I think that is the key thing. But then patience. Some, as I said earlier, some deals I've been working on for a year, and not getting frustrated, not throwing your toys out the pram when it's not necessarily going your way, all those sorts of things. Just the patience is, and I'll give you an example actually. So I've had a client, so we're trying to buy a property and my client hates the seller and hates the seller's agent. And for some reason, they've started to communicate directly, which I should have never allowed to happen, to be fair. But it's gotten quite
feisty.
It's gotten very feisty. Yeah. And it's, okay, you guys never speak again. I'm going to step in. And I, honestly, I kid you not, I sat on the phone for probably 40 minutes. The first 36 minutes, I didn't say a word. I was basically shouted at. Mm-hmm. About all the things my client had done wrong and this and that, and now the price is X and blah, 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 blah. I didn't say a word. I'm just getting berated for something I didn't do. But okay, I sit there and listen. Okay, fine. I apologize. And then how are we moving forward? That's all. So again, the patience.
Outcomes focus.
And then outcomes. Patience, then outcomes. Patience, patience. And what helps the patience is the outcomes. I know what I need to happen here. for a successful outcome for me. So therefore, to get that outcome, I have to be patient.
You know, you talk about that situation. Mm. What's the most stressful aspect of the job, would you say?
Probably the patience. Yeah.
It's a skill you need, but it gives you the most stress.
I think it is the most difficult because, again, getting your ear chewed off, whether in a good or bad way, because some clients are just very chatty, mm-hmm. right? So they can just talk. And some agents are like that as well. They just talk and talk and you're just listening, right? But then I think that patience thing is the key thing for me. I think that's the hardest thing to do, especially where it may be the deal's not progressing as quickly as you'd like. Maybe your client is delaying things or wasting a bit of time, or they've traveled, or they can't look at it because they're away. They can't make a decision because they're away. Now it's 2 weeks, and you know they could look at that email and make a decision, and you can get on with what you need to do, but their decision is holding up your progress, right? And so just sitting still is frustrating sometimes.
I hear that. On the reverse, what would you say is the most rewarding thing?
I'm very fortunate I don't have any bad clients. All my clients are in sectors that help people, whether that's childcare, whether that's community groups, whether that's religious groups. They're all helping people. They're all providing a service to society. So actually, I get a lot of joy out of performing for them, right? Like mm-hmm. do a deal for them, secure them a property, negotiate a good rent-free period for them, whatever it may be. But seeing them get a good result is probably the best thing for me. And again, so with some of the church clients, for example, it may be, okay, I've got them a building. And then they'll invite me to their first service when they open the building, and you get to see the whole congregation, how happy they are, mm-hmm. how much it means to them. Mm-hmm. That's a very fulfilling thing, mm-hmm. right? So actually going back and seeing what the client's done with it, the changes that have taken place, seeing a successful business running from the place, they're full up, Ofsted outstanding, all that good stuff. Yeah, I like all of that.
Obviously, you decided to go into this at a young age. Mm-hmm. Do you love what you do? Do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I really like my job. I think I'm very fortunate that I like my job. I'm out of the office a lot. I get to talk to people, a diverse mix of people. So whether that's, so even if just talk about churches now, I've got like Filipino churches, like African-based churches, Chinese church clients, just all over. I've got Indian churches. It's so diverse. Mm-hmm. And then on the nursery side of things, again, most of my clients on the nursery side of things are women.
Not the dominating male.
I hear that. Again, if I'm dealing with agents, it's predominantly older white males. But in terms of the operators on the nursery side of things, they're mainly women. So it's that. I think that's quite nice. And that's interesting, actually. Well, it kind of makes sense, seeing as a lot of my clients actually started their nurseries when they were looking for a nursery for their child. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't find one that was adequate. They thought, well, I can do this. Set up a nursery. Turned out they could do it. Worked out. Opened a few more. And now they've got a chain.
James, thanks for all the insights. Just a couple of questions before we get into the quick fire round and wrap mm-hmm. up. The first thing, you know, you've mentioned about the diversity and the fact that you love the job. Where do you see yourself and the property sector in the next 5 and 10 years?
Myself, I see myself still doing this, hopefully with a bigger team, just helping more people. I think the industry is becoming more important, or the industries I work in are becoming more important. There's a lot going on at the moment, cost of living stuff. You saw the government have changed things in terms of funding for childcare places as well, that there's a lot of need for these sectors. Mm-hmm. So I hope to be able to help more people make a greater, or help them make a greater impact, I should say. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are probably worried in terms of what's going to happen, but property always bounces back for a reason.
Yeah.
A lot of people's pensions are tied up in property.
Don't go giving nobody no heart attack on this podcast, man.
I mean that to say, if the property market actually failed, everything's done.
It's peaked.
So right. Yeah, and I don't think the powers that be will allow that to happen. Mm. They will step in when they need to.
It sounds like you do a lot of work. Mm. Would you say you've got a good work-life balance?
Yeah, I work hard, but also play hard. So I think everything's about balance, right? So getting that balance right,
That must balance.
Yeah, everything must balance. So I play football. I see friends. I travel quite a bit. I work when I travel as well, obviously, because I have to. But yeah, I think it all works out. I think if you're not running your own business, the work-life balance will be even better, especially if you're going to go into commercial property as opposed to residential. So we don't work weekends. We work normal sort of 9 to 5 hours. All my viewings are 9 to 5, right? So it's not the same as residential where you're working late into the evening or you've got to work Saturdays and Sundays because that's when people have off work to come and see properties. We don't have to deal with that. We're dealing with businesses. If you're thinking agency side, it's going to be about how hard you want to work because that directly affects how much money goes into your pocket. So you can work extremely long hours and make more money, or you can step off a bit and make less money but have more balance.
To anybody who's thinking of starting their own thing, what advice would you give to them?
I'd say think carefully. I think it's a personality thing. How self-motivated are you? What's your why? I think you need to have a very good reason to do it. Otherwise, you won't last. And I think I would say wait until you've got some experience. I think you probably want to start after you've had a couple of years in whatever your industry is or your sector of property is, so that you know how it works. I think I would have benefited massively if I'd worked for another agency and knew the processes, knew exactly what I needed to do, and then I could just replicate that on my own.
Could have saved yourself some years of pain.
I could have saved myself some pain, you know, but it is what it is. We got here in the end, but that's what I would say. And I think you could just, I think I would take time with it. Mm-hmm. I would take time. Go work for an agent, even if you want to start in resi, because that's, residential is probably the easiest way to get into property. So I'd say go work for a high street agent or whatever, get your work experience there, understand how that side of things work, and then try and transition to a commercial agent.
James, this has been such a great conversation, man. Thank you for being so open and sharing. Before we finish, mate, just a quick fire round, yep, so the fans can get to know a little bit more about you. Work from home or work from the office?
Office.
Money or happiness? It's a long pause.
Happiness with money.
I hear it. Favourite day of the week?
Wednesday.
Time in a group or time alone?
Group.
Mate, why the hell is your favourite day Wednesday? We won't come back to that. Damn. Would you rather travel to the past or to the future?
Future.
Favourite book?
The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F.
Yeah, Mark Manson, I hear ya. Night out or night in?
Out.
Who has it easier, men or women?
Women.
Whoa! Woof, woof, woof.
Always.
Mate, don't try and get us cancelled out there. I'm going to say men.
No, I said I like working with women earlier.
Balance. I hear you. Name a book you think everyone should read.
The Richest Man in Babylon.
All right, nice. I'm going to put that on my list. And are you listening to any good podcasts at the moment?
What My Best Friend Does.
Cheers!
Love that. Come on. Love that. Grr, grr. I listen to like mainly chilled podcasts. So yeah.
So What My Best Friend Does. Okay. Yeah, so all right, man. We do have a closing tradition on the podcast. Mm-hmm. So based on our conversation and everything that you know now, what advice would you give your 16-year-old self, and would you still be doing the same thing?
I'd still be doing the same thing, I think. I think I would say to myself, get a little bit more experience before starting out. Maybe I would have stayed in that company, right? If I'd worked for someone else and I'd been doing great, I might not have been incentivized to start my own thing.
A slave to the 9 to 5.
But I think that's probably the key thing that I could have done differently is, work for someone else and then starting my own thing with a bit more experience behind me.
Thank you so much for your time today. This has been such a wonderful conversation. To the listener, if you've made it this far, make sure you like, subscribe, comment, share, do all them things. And I think this is it for season one, by the way. This is going to be episode 10. Hope you've enjoyed all of the episodes so far. Make sure you comment, let us know any other professions that you want to learn about. This has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Over and out.